Y'all, you're never going to believe this, but on today's episode of the Innovation Room, you're going to hear how the fate of North American science was literally determined by the flip of a coin, the story of when one of our science had a run-in with a rhinoceros, yes, really, and what decades of experience in the sign industry has taught our CEO about what the future holds. Welcome back to the Innovation Room podcast, y'all. I'm your host, Tori, here with my co-host, Jonathan. And this is a special episode because we get to talk to our president and CEO, John Yarger, about the history that shaped North American signs and his take on how the state of the world is influencing the sign industry. But before we introduce him, don't forget to like and share this episode, subscribe to the podcast, and let us know what you think in the comments.
Today, we're excited to welcome North American Signs President and CEO John Yarger to the podcast. He's a third generation owner of NASS, and he has many years of experience in the sign industry. I think his earliest trade show was when he was 3 years old. Is that right, John?
Oh,
three months old.
So, yeah, wow. He's got a lot of experience. He's actually the former chair of the International Sign Association Board of Directors, the former chair of the Sign Research Foundation. So, John really knows his stuff. And today he's going to tell us a little bit more about the early history of North American signs and where he thinks the industry is headed.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So, John, a couple months ago, our whole company, we came together for some in-person training, and it was really fun, great experience, great learning experience. And one of the things that our team afterwards said that they enjoyed the most was getting to hear some of the early history of North American signs straight from you. And I was, as we were there in the training listening to you share these stories, I was thinking, like, we've got to get this recorded. Like, we need to get John back on the podcast so we can have some of this recorded. So, John, the early years of NASS were really interesting. Can you tell us how NASS began and how your family has just helped to develop and grow the company?
Yeah, well, my grandfather started the business back in 1934. He had a partner. The two of them were looking for a business to start, and they ran across this new technology that was just starting to kind of roll out across the United States. You would license the ability to make neon from a French company. And they decided that would be an interesting way to start a business back in the Depression, basically. So challenging time, but new technology, very exciting. So he started that business back in 1934. After about a year, he and his partner decided they couldn't work together anymore, that it just wasn't going to work out. So they weren't sure who was going to buy who out. And they weren't sure what the company was worth. So they decided they'd decide what the company was worth first and then decide who was going to buy who out, because obviously the value differences would be a lot different if they knew who was going to buy whom. So they decided on a price. I'm not sure what it was, but they came up with an amount that either of them would be willing to either pay and or receive. And then they flipped a coin to figure out who would get the company.
Literally flipped a coin.
Yeah. To see who would buy whom out. And he won the coin toss. My grandfather did. So he bought his partner out.
At the time.
Yeah, no, I joke now sometimes that, you know, he lost the coin toss. No, it's been a great industry to be in, and it's been great for the family as well. So so he won the coin toss and bought his partner out and then started off on his own.
So what, you're the third generation owner. What about the second generation?
Yeah, so my grandfather actually died of a heart attack. He was a smoker. And at the age of 49, he passed away of a sudden massive heart attack, which was a real trauma in the family and real upsetting. Dad basically was tasked with taking over the company at that point. And so my father took over in 1959 and started running the company himself.
He couldn't have been very old then, right? If it was 49 when your grand, he must have been in his 20s, right? At most.
Dad was 21, really just out of college.
Hey, here, you're going to run this company now.
Yeah, he had actually started his master's degree at the London School of Economics, and he had to fly back for the funeral and then was talked into staying and running the company instead of finishing his master's in economics. So, surprise to him, surprise to the whole family. And it was very stressful for him. He always talks about how difficult it was those early years. And, you know, he had a sales manager who thought he should be running the company and a production manager who thought he should be running the company and a bank who was concerned about the loan and just lots of moving parts. So he took it over and ran it for about 8 years himself. During that time, he went back to school at Chicago and got his MBA from the University of Chicago as well. So he'd run the company from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then go to Chicago and take classes Thursday, Friday, study Saturday and Sunday, and then go back to running the business. And he had a general manager who helped him, but that was a rough time. But he met Mom during that time, and the two of them were married. And about the time I was born, my uncle joined him. My uncle had gotten through college and had worked a few jobs. He was had an engineering degree. So the two of them ran it together from then for about 30 years together. And they played off of each other well. Dad was the idea person and always coming up with new concepts and new things. And my uncle would choose the ones that he thought were most valuable and implement them. My uncle ran mainly accounting in the shop, and my dad ran mainly sales and the office. And the two of them did very well. They grew in the 70s, started going after national accounts as more and more retailing started to go national in the early 70s. He started to work some national accounts and then grew that, expanded that in the 80s. And I worked summers in the 80s and then came back to the company after working a few different jobs and finishing my school in 1996. And then we started to do actually some more international work, but more national work, but also international work, and continued to grow the company through the 2000s and since then. So it's been quite a ride. And obviously my transition was much smoother and easier and
measured, yeah.
and less stressful for the most part, although there's always stress in the business world. So faced a lot of challenges. I often look back to the recession and say, my grandfather started the business in the recession. I can survive, you know, a recession or other business challenges. We'll figure it out.
I love that. And when did the company make the change from South Bend Neon, which was the original sort of brand, to North American Sign?
Yeah, that was done in the early 70s as they started to look at more national work. They realized that South Bend used to be a quality name. There was South Bend Watch, which was considered some of the best watches in the country. There was South Bend Lure, which made fishing lures, which were considered the best fishing lures. There were a lot of South Bend companies that played off that name over the history of South Bend manufacturing. The base of Studebaker and Oliver Plow and some of the other Singer sewing machines were here off of that manufacturing base. So South Bend Neon was seen as a quality name, but it wasn't really recognized that way by the 70s. And he wanted to impart the idea that we could do national work. So they changed it to North American Signs in the early 70s.
Very smart business move.
Right. Yeah. Makes sense. I mean, it kind of fits too, right? You know, you're going to go national and be, I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that are like, man, that's like the perfect fitting name for a national sign company, you know?
Luckily they got it early and trademarked right. it early.
Yeah. So. That's great. So yeah, when it comes to signs, you know, and all the challenges that come with manufacturing, installing, North American Signs has kind of really seen it all, right? And with that in mind, I know that there's a story that's kind of part of NASA's history that a lot of people just haven't heard, but it's involving one of our signs, a rhinoceros, and your father. Can you share that story with us today?
Yeah, that's one of the crazy ones. There's a number of crazy ones, and that's one of them. I always remember this because it's one of my favorite memories as a kid growing up of hearing the rhinoceros stories. So my dad was starting to ship signs, and my uncle over throughout the country. And back in the 70s, one way to ship them, you know, trucks were around, but they weren't as necessarily as popular, and they were expensive. So he shipped it by rail. He was shipping a large cabinet sign by rail for a company across the country. So they were loading the sign or switching the sign at a switch yard from one flatbed to another flatbed, very large sign. And as they were lifting it, it gave way and fell. And as obviously damaging as that could be, there happened to be a circus train passing through at the same time in the freight yard, and it fell into the rhinoceros cage, the rail car holding the rhinoceros for the circus. The rhinoceros got very upset and charged and gored the sign on top of the damage that it already had. So as a salesperson, I'm sure anybody out there who's done sales before had to make the ugly call to the customer saying, I'm sorry, we're going to be a little late on this installation. I have to remake the sign because it was gored by a rhinoceros.
Right.
So explaining that to a customer, of all the things we have to explain, those are some of the best stories, right? Is when you
right.
have to go back to a customer and say, I don't know how this happened, but it happened.
So. Well, and also just the circuses back then. I mean, I remember going to circuses as a kid. I never saw a rhino. I mean, it was elephants and tigers and everything. But yeah, that's it's just crazy. I wouldn't want to make that call. But hopefully the customer was good natured about it and realized that it's a story they can tell as well, you know?
Yeah,
I think the customer didn't believe him at first, and then
I was gonna say it's like no teacher really like the dog ate my homework,
right?
Like, no.
Although at some point I think the customer said, you know, you wouldn't make that up, right? Yeah,
you
right.
can't make yeah. that up. Like, it's too crazy.
It's too crazy.
Even back then, I mean, you're thinking about it, right? Like, how do you prove that? Like, well, okay, I'll take a picture, I'll get it developed at the grocery store, at the, you know, corner drugstore, I'll mail it to you. You'll have the evidence in, you know, 3 weeks. That by then we'll have the new sign out there and installed, but you know, no. you'll have the pictures of it.
Going back that yard that far, you went to the photography, you know, studio. You oh. didn't even go to the corner drugstore, right?
Right. Yeah. It wasn't as Kodak wasn't, you know, the quick film development.
It wasn't you didn't take it to one of the local drugstores and get right. it. You know, shoot yeah. it over there via email and get it printed out.
Wow.
Yeah, makes
wow.
sense.
A different time for sure. Yeah. And I, you know, there are, I'm sure, many more stories of that variety that you could tell since we, you know, North American Science has been in business for 91 years. But kind of setting those crazy stories aside, the industry has really transformed over the course of North American Science history. And it's even changed pretty significantly since you joined the company, John. So in your time, what would you say has been the most significant change or innovation in the sign industry?
Yeah. I mean, from a technology point of view, I think it's been LEDs. You know, back in the 80s, my dad even made his own electronic message centers, and they were incandescent lights with little bezels around them, little cups around them. So even, I mean, that was one of the earliest uses of LEDs in the industry, was in electronic message centers. But then, you know, when I came back, we weren't using EMCs or LEDs at all. They still hadn't been used in the sign industry really much at all. They were very expensive still. The light output wasn't very strong. They just weren't ready yet. We started incorporating them in the late 90s into some specialty applications. And we were one of the first people I know that used them, because you couldn't use them for a lot of applications. You had to have a very special reason to use them. And we did. We had some structural components we had to get around, and then some subcopy. We wanted to be not as bright as the main sign. And so actually having it dimmer and having it very thin, was both were important to us. So it worked out in that application. but it didn't work for the rest of the signs. It wouldn't work for a normal sign. So we had the opportunity then to start to experiment with it, to get involved with the manufacturers or the people who are selling it and start to develop it and understand it early on. And, you know, it's been a huge change and continues to adapt and, you know, shift as the price comes down. But it's changed so much about how we build signs, about how thick they need to be, about how heavy they need to be, about what materials we can use, about the electrical requirements, how much electricity sign use has come down. I mean, you were with neon, you're using 3,000 to 15,000 volt transformers to get the voltage up high enough. And, you know, with LEDs, as you know, probably they're with the power supply, you're taking it down to 12 or 24 volts. So it's a huge difference in safety and fire risk and as well in the materials that we use to build the signs. So it's changed really so much about the sign industry. It's hard sometimes to understand all the differences. There's also been a change, certainly, I think, in the diversity and the professionalism. When I'd go to sign shows when I was young, you know, it was pretty much everybody was male on the floor. You could probably count the number of females on the floor on one hand.
Oh, wow.
And it was really refreshing to see it have changed a lot when I came back. And then even now, the number of women involved, the number of minorities involved, and the professionalism of everybody. You know, you still have people who have worked on trucks starting and building small, you know, installation companies, and that's great. They have a lot of talent, but you also see a lot more professional approaches to how we work, how we do business. That's been super to see as well.
So obviously one of the biggest questions people always ask is, you know, what's coming next? You mentioned a lot about LED and how that was a big game changer. And you've mentioned many times that the sign industry is fairly mature, and now there really isn't a lot of innovation that's happening like really quickly. But the industry is still evolving. What do you see as trends and patterns or anything that could shape the industry in the next, you know, say 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, well, largely the industry follows the economy. You know, where is their development? Where is there the need for signs? You know, retail isn't building out like it was. So through the 70s, 80s, 90s, even the 2000s, especially maybe internationally, companies were building out retail aggressively. As Amazon started to come on and online shopping and other forms started to go, you really saw that then retail not be so aggressive about the expansion and the housing market as well. You know, you didn't see the addition of as many homes and neighborhoods and then therefore commercial properties around it. There's still some, of course, and there's backfill, which is, you know, very important to keep moving. And we, as an industry, you know, that can work for us as well. But you see those shifts. So it'll be interesting to see how the economy continues to develop and where that leads the industry. As far as technology and things in the industry, you know, the digitization of everything just continues. AI is going to have an impact on a number of areas, from design to, you know, how we all work in the office. And all those types of things are going to drive back office changes largely, although some of it'll seep out into how we do business, you know, outside the four walls as well.
Right. So one of the things that I don't know for your opinion on is with the online ordering, and you mentioned that there's been a shift away from retail. Like, there's a lot of stuff where, you know, as I'm going to make a purchase through Amazon or something online, I'm starting to double think or, you know, rethink my decision. Like, does this make sense to buy it online? You know, because with Amazon and Temu and just all these things that you see online, you know, do you think, and you're just, well, what am I going to get? Is it actually going to be the thing that I want? You know, do you see maybe there could be a shift back into retail if there becomes too much distrust in quality products online?
Oh, yeah. I think if the online, what do you want to call it? economy isn't careful about how they manage things. As shipping costs go up, as you start to get return fees, you know, for a long time, you hardly ever saw a return fee. And now you see discounts off your return and other types of issues. You know, are you willing to buy 3 articles of clothing to make sure you get the right size and then return 2 of them? That's a that's somewhat common consumer behavior, especially if they want it for an event or something that's coming up and there's a time deadline. But then if you have to have a discount or you have to pay the freight to return the 2 that don't fit, you start to get more nervous about that. So I think, I mean, there'll always be a need for in-person retail. There's certain things that you just, you know, you want to go pick up. If you have certain dietary restrictions or something and you want to go to the grocery store, you can't deal with substitutes from an online shopping, even with grocery delivery. So there's all sorts of reasons why people will still want to go to stores. Part of the issue right now you see is declining choice when you're in the store, right? You want this, we can get it to you. So, you know, the idea of having the ability to touch things and see things and, you know, go into Best Buy and still, you know, they have a display unit, but if you want that color, you have to order it. Well, that's maybe okay and maybe not okay. I think the online, our ability to touch and feel things online is still limited. Will virtual reality with gloves or something eventually get there? Maybe, but people still like the experience of going to the mall occasionally. We still think of the experience economy. And retail was always a part of that experience economy. So I think it'll always be a part of it. It's how big a part, it's how fast does it grow, it's what the backfill is into the malls survive and things like that.
No, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think I love to shop. I'm sure that's a shock to everyone. But I think I see that just in the places where I go to shop, that a lot of brands are shifting more to, like you said, John, and it kind of more of an experience, right? So when I come into the store, like, am I being touched in all 5 senses or most of my senses? Is there something that's going to draw me in more than just like cute clothes or something? So it seems like the brands that are capturing that well seem to be thriving in their brick and mortar approach. But then there's also the model of like a Dollar General, which is probably the only retail brand that's like actually growing super rapidly still. But that's because of their really, seems like more because of their really unique market, right? They can go to places where no one else can because what they're providing is so inexpensive. So they're kind of a little bit of an island, it seems like, but other brands are leaning more into the experience side of things, like you said.
Well, and you even see the online brands, some of them opening physical stores where very strategically where they can get high volume and but be out there somewhat physically so that people can go in and experience their products and the fun of shopping in person. And the marriage of the experiential with the retail, I think, is important as well. I mean, if you have a dressing room now, people want to be able to take a selfie and send it to their friends. And so your dressing room needs to look different than it looked 10 years ago or 20 years ago, certainly. You want that dressing room to be a fun place in a picture, right? There's
gotta be Instagrammable there
as well for the retail to create an experience and the chance to provide a good image for themselves, even in the dressing rooms, that they hadn't thought of before and they need to be thinking about to create that experiential. Oh no, let's go and try this dress on. I want to shoot a picture out to the whole wedding party and show them what my dress is going to look like.
Yes. Yeah. That's not to plug, but that's where signage comes in, right? Is for those brands looking to cultivate that really delightful branded experience for their customers, you've got to lean into the design and the signage as well. So we've kind of segued into what my next question was going to be, but John, how do you see, like, we know that signage is an important part of the customer experience. They don't typically realize it, but it actually is very important to them. Do you see the role of signage evolving when it comes to shaping the customer experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been thought of as, you know, a lot of it's been thought of as the sign pulls a person in, you know, it's a recognition of brand. It tells you something about the store. Is it fun? You know, is it a multicolored sign? Is it very elegant? Is it bright? And you go everything from, you know, bright brass and pink to very staid. And, you know, like if you're a financial firm, you want to look very solid and maybe stately or, you know, trustworthy, certainly. So you have all these different concepts that you convey partly through your logo, through your coloring, through your brand, and that all comes out in your signage. And I think the opportunities now, and companies are certainly recognizing this much more, is on the interior, you know, extending that brand more fully into their interiors. You know, it's been some degree in retail and cash wraps, but in store displays, but also expanding that, as we said, into the dressing rooms is an opportunity. I mean, why not have a vinyl on the wall or some flat cutout letters on the wall or something on the wall that reinforces your brand when people are in there as well? So I think the opportunity to extend the brand even further continues to take shape and shift.
And not just in the retail space, right? Like we do quite a bit of interior signage for brands, you know, finance brands, all sorts of different kind of corporate energy type of places.
Corporate and offices where you have visitors, you know, even like a logistics company might want branding and better facilities for, you know, the people passing through their facility.
Or even for their own employees.
Yeah.
Right.
A lot of that as well. You creating the atmosphere for employees, especially as, you know, the labor market tightens and then and shifts, you know, creating that culture, reinforcing that culture, creating a pride of place is very important. And we're definitely seeing more and more of that.
Right. It seems like it's, to me, you're losing it part of in remote work. But when you have people returning to the office now, it reminds me of, I can't remember how long ago it was, but I studied it in marketing where they had subtext in the music that was played in grocery stores about, you know, subconsciously don't steal, things like that. And it wasn't for the customers. It was for the employees because they would be hearing it and would actually be affected by the subconscious, you know, subtext that was put into the songs and everything. That now, you mean, it's a similar idea, right? You want people to want to be there. So you want to make it a welcoming place. Nobody wants to walk into a gray, dreary, dimly lit office. You want it to be bright and fun and give people a reason to want to come back to the office. And so yeah, I see signage playing a huge part in companies trying to do that. So
yeah.
But yeah, so like in that kind of mindset, switching it to like the workforce itself, it's always a challenge, right? So what skills and mindsets do you think the next generation of signage professionals are going to need in order to be successful? And how should like our company and others start preparing the workforce for that future?
Well, the continued use of computers and more manufacturing is something that more and more people have their hands on machines that are run by computers or, you know,
right,
computer chips, even the bending machines, the brakes, the shears, all of that is becoming more and more computerized. In some cases, that makes it easier to run. The interfaces are better. In other cases, you know, there's just training that needs to be done there. So there's a continual upgrade of skills starting at the shop floor that we've all got to be thinking about and keeping in mind as well, of course, for the office and all the changes coming. You know, AI is the hot topic now for everybody.
Yeah.
So we'd be remiss not to mention it and say, you know, providing some access to that and helping people experiment with it and allowing them to experiment with it is important. It does some things well, some things they say it's delusional. I don't think any of my teachers in high school called me delusional when I made an error. which is what I think of when I think of what AI does. It's not delusional. It's wrong. but it's delusional and we're all wrong. So, you know, as it gets, but it's going to continue to improve just like LEDs did. It might get less expensive. It might get more expensive as it's able to do more. But it's going to continue to transform what we can do, how quickly we can do it. I don't think it'll ever substitute totally for people. People right. need to still be driving things and making decisions and, you know, moving things along. Project managers are still key to the whole industry. You know, people on the shop floor are still key to the whole industry. Designers are still key. You can ask, you can get some ideas, but you need to check everything that's done by AI still. And that'll reduce and it'll, but you're still going to have to check it or there's going to be errors. So I see those all as important parts of what we can continue to develop, both on the shop side and the office side.
So we kind of touched on this a couple minutes ago, but I want to circle back and make sure we've heard all your thoughts on the topic. But with, you know, everything right now, we've got an administration that we're not quite sure like what's going to happen next. And just overall with the state of the US economy and kind of the global economy, I think it bears talking about again. So do you have anything else to add to that topic of how the economies are shaping the sign industry?
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, you know, the economy really leads us to where the opportunities are and where we can fulfill and better provide, you know, identity, wayfinding, all those sorts of things. And people want better and better experiences. So, you know, the wayfinding continues to expand because people are more aware that trying to navigate through a hospital can be a challenging task. And so how do we improve that? And how do we make that better? And, you know, the sign industry really hasn't played a large role in that until I'd say the last 5, maybe 10 years. And there's still so much for us that we can help the hospitals understand how to get people from place A to place B better, from their front door up to a room, from the front door to a visitor area. There's so much more to be done there in terms of wayfinding. So I see that as another big area. I see, you know, continued shifts in experiential. You know, amusement parks have been around for a long time and considered the, I guess, one of the epitome of experiential, and they continue to refresh themselves and adapt. And they're going to continue to do that. And other places are going to look for those experiential opportunities to build that in, to draw people in. So where we can be doing that and helping them, I think is going to be where the opportunities are. Certainly continued use of LED signs and in smaller and smaller areas and capacities, and just that whole area will continue to develop as well. So there's a lot of possibilities for the industry. And the economy's, you know, yeah, the regulatory changes, all those types of things continue to impact us as it does the overall economy. And there'll be shifts back and forth. We might see some lightening of regulatory issues. Some of those will come back. Some of them will come in different areas. And we'll continue to adapt and change and figure out how to build a business on that. You know, one of the best things about being in the United States is we have a really resilient economy. We have a lot of opportunity and we adapt fast when we need to. And so with the coming challenges, I think we'll continue to adapt quickly and figure it out and find ways to be successful, whatever the future holds. I'm really optimistic in that regard.
Wow, that's very encouraging to hear. I think not everyone has that take on where the economy is going. So it's encouraging and uplifting to hear that. John, thank you so much for being on the show today. We appreciate your insights.
I'm glad to be invited and it's great to see you all.
Yeah, definitely. We appreciate it.
Well, Jonathan, as always, this was a great jam-packed episode. Tons of insights from John. What is your key takeaway?
Well, obviously, it's don't leave a sign in a rhinoceros cage because, yeah. You know, then you'll have to explain why it got gored. But I think one of the best things is the innovation is still coming into the sign industry. You know, it's like we haven't completely plateaued yet. There's going to be ways that we can improve, and there's always going to be things that we can do better. And, you know, new things are going to pop up that we might not even know about at this point, and how, you know, computers are going to play a big part in how they can do that and what we can do with it. And then also the overall positive economic outlook that he had on the state of not just the industry, but, you know, the economy moving forward is always, you know, kind of great to hear somebody with, you know, great insights and just a good outlook, you know, because there's so much negative right now. It's good to see, like, you know, hey, we will get out of it. We will come out stronger for it. So that's always great.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, right along with that, I think the AI is not going to take your jobs, you know?
Yeah, right.
Right. Which is still like some... That's a kind of a myth that I think has been largely debunked, but I think it bears repeating. You know, there's still kind of right. that underlying fear. Like I'm in marketing. Like I understand. I'm like, there's AI that does a lot of stuff for me now. Like, will it achieve a place where I'm actually not needed?
Right.
And
right.
you know, and it's quite possible that somewhere very, very far down the road that could be the case. But you know, AI is still in its infant stage. It still needs a lot of support and help, and to be checked by people. And so, you know, it's doubtful that jobs will be entirely taken over. Doesn't mean that we need to reskill. Absolutely. But that's encouraging to hear.
Well, and also, with like the AI and taking over as just for an example, a podcast host, right? There's going to be people that seek out the AI, and then there's going to be people that seek out I want to make sure it's an actual person, like those type of things. I think that'll always be in existence.
For sure. I think my key takeaway from this episode, or just something that I have always really admired about John and his family, is they obviously care so much about the company, and they really honor the history of the company. And it speaks, I think, to the culture at North American Signs, but just, you know, I hope that other companies are able to honor their history in the way that we're able to, and, you know, just acknowledging what a valuable indicator of, I guess, company culture it is, that we care so much about where we've been and, you know, and understand how that shapes where we're going. North American Signs has always been an innovator, and so it's exciting to be a part of a company that will continue to do that in the future, even though sometimes the industry is a little slow moving, as we noted. But yeah, I just really respect that approach from the Yarger family for sure.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's a wrap on this episode. John always offers interesting insights, and it was a pleasure to have him on.
Absolutely. Y'all, thanks for joining us. Don't forget to like and share this episode. Subscribe to the podcast. Let us know what other industry trends you're seeing, or if you have any crazy signage stories. Until next time, keep innovating.